Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. From landing a probe on a comet to even more discoveries on Mars, it has been quite a year for astrophysics and cosmology.
Our astronomy contributor, Gene Creighton, joins us each month to help us keep track of the latest astronomical news. Today, we look back at three big stories, starting with the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission, which landed a probe on a comet in November.
It's hard to imagine the excitement of a person in that control room, because when we see it as spectators, we think, oh yeah, that's cool, that's really cool, that's great. But they know all the things that could have gone wrong, all the things that had to go right for this to work just as hoped.
And many, many, many years.
And many years. People's whole career or half their career, you know, they've spent to get to this golden moment. And so much rides on, you know, as I said, things going properly. So it's just one of those magic moments that you can experience if you've been there once before, because I've experienced this once before where a satellite goes into orbit in the right place. It's such a happy, happy time. So you kind of feel for them, feel the excitement of just succeeding to do something so hard, to manage to send a probe so that it lands at a particular place at a particular time, sticks on a comet, and you remember perhaps how tricky that was. There was lots of hours of uncertainty. Well, it's sort
and
of
it's a moving target going very, very, very,
very
fast.
Very fast. Yeah. It's drifting slowly. Gravity has a weak hold on this. It was drifting for hours, slowly falling to the comet, and it stuck. And we have 60 hours worth of data from that comet. I suspect that many PhDs are to be had from that data. And already they've introduced some of the first results that, for example, they measured carefully the isotopic ratios of hydrogen, and they find that the hydrogen flavor, if you will, on the comet is different than the hydrogen flavor we see in water on Earth, which probably tells us that the idea that, you know, all the water came from comets falling on Earth probably isn't the only answer. It could be partly. I mean, it could be that different comets have different isotopic ratios, but just this kind of comet probably wouldn't do the trick.
One of the things I know that happened in the landing is that it landed on its side. Is the idea that as the comet gets closer to the sun, that the actual lander is going to repower?
That's the hope.
That's the hope.
That's the hope. I think everybody was really clear on this one, that any data they got would have been bonus. They understood that the battery was going to be an issue, and that with any luck, maybe as it got closer to the sun, it would get enough energy to reboot, if you will, the system. But that was always considered gravy. If that happened, that would be great. But they understood from the start that would have been tricky.
So the 60 hours is already the cake and the icing. So
that's right.
If it actually boots up, that's the cherry on top.
Exactly.
Of the,
exactly. Yeah. For a better metaphor. Yeah. Thank you. Yep.
Okay, yep. So I know we've only started to parse the data from that. Do they have particular hopes of what they're looking for, or is it pretty much just sort of like whatever it tells us, we're going to kind of plug it into our body of knowledge?
Well, the nice thing about comets is that they give you a real look at what the solar nebula, what we call the solar nebula. So that is the original cloud that formed the sun and gave the ingredients to build the planets. What that was like, because these comets froze out of the nebula when the solar system was very young. This is really the earliest stuff we can grab from that era. So it tells us a lot about the history of the solar system. So it tells us about comets. It tells us about how the solar system changed over time. It tells us even possibly about how life might have got a boost on Earth and things perhaps that we haven't even considered. That's the beauty of these missions, that you get to investigate questions that you have, but sometimes even more excitedly, you get new questions that you hadn't considered.
If the battery does get recharged, when would that happen? How much longer are we looking in the comet's trajectory?
I don't know the answer precisely, but I think it would be on the order of a few months.
Okay,
as
so
it
we'll
gets
know.
Closer to the sun. Some of these comets have highly elliptical orbits, so their farthest distance can be many, many light years away. and to the closest approach could be a fraction of a light year. So the amount of energy they receive from the sun is going to significantly increase as it gets closer.
Right.
Because the radiation here would be increasing as the inverse of the square of the distance. So in other words, if you decrease the distance by half, you increase the intensity of the radiation that you get by a factor of 4. The effect is very noticeable.
Okay. So we should know in the next couple of months then whether that's going to reboot itself, the lander.
It might be a few more, but yes, yeah. We will know.
Sometime in 2015. Well, landing on a comet wasn't the only exciting thing that happened.
No.
Mars had a big year.
It sure did. Well, let's just start with what's on the ground. Curiosity celebrated its second year now on the ground. And this little rover that could has been buzzing around, and it's finally reached the bottom of Mount Sharp. This is an interesting feature on Mars because it's at the center of this huge crater, Gale Crater. And this feature caught people's eyes some years ago thinking, okay, we know all about craters. We know quite a bit about craters, right? How they form. We have objects coming from space. They slam into the ground. They make these nice crater structures. And it's not uncommon that at the very center of the crater, you get a little blip, I want to call it, some little rising that just happens when you throw. I mean, you can do this experiment at home. If you take a bucket of flour and put a little bit of hot cocoa on top just so that you can see clearly the layers, and you take a ball, dump it in the flour, you're going to get very likely a nice crater with a little bump in the center. And sometimes if you're lucky, you might get some radial features that we can see, say, on the moon, right?
Okay.
So you can reproduce a crater of your own. The thing is that this isn't just a little blip in the center. This is a fairly tall mountain. And the best ideas that we had as how that might have happened was that the crater filled with some kind of liquid over time, and eventually that dried up and winds formed around this small feature that eroded some of this material and had this mountain sticking out from the crater. This sounds a little far-fetched. And also, it turns out that this feature is highly stratified. This isn't the kind of feature you would get, say, from a volcano, because that was another idea. Well, maybe we had some kind of old volcano that produced this feature. Well, it turns out that now that Curiosity is starting to explore this region, we will learn more about how it might have formed. What is clear is that it certainly does have a lot of strata from different eras, which tells us that maybe water came and went. So we had water standing there, but then it would go away. There are clear river deltas in the region. So there have been changes in the water quantity, but there have been maybe recurrent episodes over reasonably long periods of time. As you know, the whole mission to Mars approach has been search for the water, follow the water, because mm-hmm. we have strong connections, certainly on our planet, between water and life. And I realize it's hard to keep track of, are you saying that there was life on Mars? No, I'm not saying that. But that there were good opportunities, friendly places at least, for life to happen over periods of time on Mars. And it also tells us that perhaps if we were to bring life to Mars, if we were to bring plants or people to Mars, maybe they could survive.
I know there was a recent report from NASA saying that Curiosity has found more organic chemistry that could have supported life.
Right. So a lot of methane has been found. In fact, the quantity of methane has changed somewhat abruptly in the last 2 years. Again, this is of interest because, as you perhaps know, there's a lot of methane in the atmosphere of the Earth. And that's mostly because of cows, actually. So here the deal is that methane is a very light gas. So left to its own devices, gravity can't hold on to it for very long. So if there is no recurrent production of methane, it's just going to go out into the universe. It's not going to stay.
Disperse.
Yeah, it's gone. So the fact that we still have a lot of methane in the Earth's atmosphere is because we have animals that produce it. Mars has a smaller gravitational field, so it would have an even harder time to hold on to the methane. So the idea is that there must be something that regenerates methane, and it could be something like, well, there's methane trapped under the ground because of volcanic activity or other geological activity in the past on Mars, or that there are bacteria somewhere in the ground that are producing methane. This, of course, is a question that we are burning to answer and is of yet unanswered.
Okay.
So I just want to go back to a point I made before because I wanted to make it clear that we know perfectly well that Mars is not a place that we could pack our bags and go to Mars and live without bringing substantial amount of infrastructure with us, namely oxygen.
All right, so there's another big thing. This next topic takes us focused down onto our solar system and expands that focus out into the entire universe. And we're talking about gravitational waves.
Mm-hmm.
And how close are we to actually saying
we've detected them? Well, we might have this answer on two different fronts in the next year. But right now, here's where we are. We have talked here before about the microwave background radiation. Cosmic microwave background radiation is the very first light that we see from the beginning of the universe. So the universe is about 13.7 billion years old. When the universe was about 400,000 years, it cooled down to the point where matter and radiation could kind of decouple, is the word that we use, that basically light could freely travel through the universe. It wasn't bogged down interacting with matter continuously. So that's the very first light that's bathing basically the whole universe right now. And because it's gotten cheapened, if you will, over time, it's gotten cooler and cooler, that background radiation can be seen in the microwave part of the spectrum. Our eyes can't see that, but we have lots of sensitive satellites now that can observe it, and our universe is sitting at about 3 degrees Kelvin, so 3 degrees over absolute zero. Very exciting stuff. And a lot of this cosmic microwave background radiation has told us most of what we know about the very early universe. Now, in that radiation, you can see polarization. It turns out that different radiation can have preferred directions, can oscillate continuously, but it can choose certain directions. And there are two kinds of radiation patterns that we see. We have either the E mode, and that's basically a radial pattern, but we can also get a B mode, which is a little weaker, but you see these faint twirls on the data. The BICEP was an experiment that earlier this year found these twirls that are associated with gravitational waves. So when the universe was even younger than this radiation, the universe, and I'm talking about a very small fraction of a second, the universe expanded dramatically from smaller than an atom to about the size of an orange in a very, very small fraction, billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second. This is called inflation. And as the universe ballooned, exploded that quickly, it imprinted on its very early radiation that gravitational waves, so that's basically ripples in space-time, that would have cemented on that radiation these twirl patterns. This was very exciting, right? The whole scientific community thought, wow, if this is true, this would be totally awesome because it captures so early a time.
Much earlier than we've ever been able to.
Much earlier. Yeah. That's right. And we've been drooling over this ability of, can we analyze the cosmic microwave background radiation to find even earlier on signatures from the Big Bang's inflation? Well, it turns out that people who study dust, and I'm talking not about dust bunnies, but I'm talking about the dust in the cosmos, said, yeah, but you get the same kind of pattern by dust grains that might force light to polarize as it travels to us. So have we done the proper treatment of the dust? And it turns out that, well, maybe we have and maybe we haven't. So in the glorious moment of scientific collaboration, both the BICEP people and the Planck people who are very good at studying, among other things, the effect of dust are coming together. So we're hoping that in the next few months, they are going to do the work together carefully so that we can figure out, yes, is this a signature of dust, which is interesting in its own right, because that connects us to all kinds of interesting things like supernova explosions, etc. Or is it, in fact, proof of gravitational waves because of inflation? Now, having said that, LIGO, which is an experiment that's been going on for a while, has just starting its advanced run, and soon they'll be able to do scientific runs. We might have an independent first look at a gravitational wave directly another way sometime in 2015, which would be very exciting indeed.
Very. Well, I'm going to end this because we have to wrap up, but you had an amazing year in 2014 as well. You got to go up on the Sophia mission.
I sure did. That was one of the highlights, certainly, of my career. I got to travel in the largest astronomical observatory in the world that looks in the infrared part of the spectrum, that sees really young stars and young galaxies. I got to do this for 20 hours. I was selected by NASA to be an airborne astronomy ambassador, which was, of course, great fun and a great honor.
It is. And it's a great honor to have you on our show. We have been doing this now, what, 6, 7 years?
Yeah.
Something like that. And I'm looking forward to many, many more. Jean, have a wonderful holiday, and we will talk to you in January.
I look forward to it. It's always a pleasure.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, located on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Astronaut Chris Hadfield shares what he gained from 3 trips to space when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We'll be back in a moment.